Welcome to All My Children Wear Fur Coats with Peggy Hoyt. Our goal is to keep loved pets in loving homes by educating pet parents about the importance of ensuring every pet has a forever home. For more information about creating a legacy for your pet or to listen to archive shows, visit animalcaretrustusa.org or legacyforyourpet.com. Join your host, author, estate planning attorney, and animal advocate, Peggy Hoyt.
Hello, pet lovers. Welcome to All My Children Wear Fur Coats. I'm your host, Peggy Hoyt. This show is brought to you by the law offices of Hoyt and Bryan, where we create estate plans for pets and their people. Also brought to you by Animal Care Trust USA, a national nonprofit dedicated to keeping loved pets in loving homes. We do this by educating pet parents about the importance of getting a pet trust for their loved pet. We also provide pet trust options and trustee services. And today, our show is so happy to present Patty Palumbo. She is a veterinarian here in Central Florida, and also a canine handler for Search and Rescue of Central Florida. So we're really looking forward to getting to know more about Patty. And welcome to the show, Dr. Palumbo.
Thank you so much, Peggy.
You are so welcome. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Palumbo. She is following in her father's footsteps, who is also a veterinarian, and I'm told he's age 83 and still practicing in South Florida. In that regard, Dr. Palumbo went to Auburn University, and she graduated in 1993. After graduating, Dr. Palumbo moved to the Orlando area and has been practicing in this area ever since. She joined the Seminole Trail Animal Hospital staff in October of 2022, and her professional interests include surgery, allergies, and sports medicine. In her spare time, she loves the beach, reading, running, and being a member of Search and Rescue of Central Florida. Do you have any free time, Dr. Palumbo?
Surprisingly, yes, I still do.
That's awesome.
It sounds like a lot, doesn't it, when you say that? It sounds like a lot.
It does sound like a lot, but you know, busy people are productive people, so we like that. So how did you become enamored with Search and Rescue?
I kind of fell into it. I was looking for an outlet, something to do. My kids had grown up and didn't need me as much, so I was looking for something to give back, something to occupy my time, and Search and Rescue kind of checked all the boxes, right? So it was a way I could give back to the community. It was a way I could be outside and be active. It was a way I could bond with my dog and other people's dogs. And I'm a tad bit obsessed with true crime, so that didn't hurt either. That kind of just checked all those boxes and was a good fit for all the things I really like to do.
Well, it sounds like a super interesting hobby because, especially because of the dogs, but because it is so unique. Not that many people do search and rescue with their dogs, and it takes quite a bit of training. So why don't you tell us about that?
Right. So it takes a lot of training for both the dog and the handler. So for Search and Rescue of Central Florida, before they will allow us to be deployable, meaning go out on calls, we have to be certified as a search and rescue technician, meaning we have to know how to read maps and compasses. We have to know how to navigate in the woods and survival techniques and first aid techniques, because the last thing they want is for us to become a victim. So the handler, and there's other positions besides dog handler in the club as well, in the team. And then for the dogs, it takes about a year or so per dog to get them trained to where they can pass the certification test that's required every year. So it's a lot of work to get there and a lot of work to continue.
So the dogs have to be certified every year.
Correct. Your brain surgeon only has to take a test once in their lifetime. My dog has to take a test every year.
Wow. That's intimidating.
It's a pretty intimidating test. And it's a 6-part test. You're allowed 1 mistake on the whole test. It's very intimidating. And the group that we certified through is the most stringent of of the organizations, right? We were certified through NAPWADA, which is National Police Working Dog Association. So we had to certify two different hides on six different types. So we had to do vehicles and buildings and outdoors and rubble and all these things. So it's a pretty intimidating test.
And then there's different kinds of search and rescue, I believe, too, right?
Correct. So my personal dogs are human remains detection dogs. There are dogs that are for tracking and trailing. So if your grandma gets lost, they'll go find grandma with a live find dog. If, you know, they think you've passed, they send us out. They also have dogs that go on avalanches, dogs that, you know, are certified through FEMA. So there's, again, lots of different certifications and levels and specialties. There are dogs that are real good at doing water, like looking for people that have passed in the water versus people that have passed in the snow versus people that are bare, you know, so it's just a lot of levels.
Is there a specific breed that lends itself to being a search and rescue dog?
Any dog that has what we call drive. So a dog that is really, really excited about a ball or a toy or food. Sometimes you can use just prey. Some dogs will work just for that, but they have to think it's a game and that they want to do it. You can't force them to do it. They have to really think this is a fun game. I get a reward at the end if I do this.
So are there a lot of dogs that people start out with to train and then discover that maybe they don't have the right skill set for that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, and it's not for everybody because, again, there's a lot of work for the handler involved. There's a lot of physical work. Some dogs become afraid of, like, being out in the woods or being far from the owner. So it's a hard thing to really, really be good at.
I just think it's so interesting that this is the kind of technical hobby that somebody can have, but it doesn't require necessarily a specific breed. So to what I'm thinking is that even rescue dogs would make good choices if they had the proper drive and intelligence.
Oh, yeah, right. So again, these dogs are our pets. That's not true for every team, but for most teams, I think it's probably true that these dogs are also our pets. We just happen to train them for this as well. And again, on our team, we have Malinois. We have my one dog is a mixed breed dog. We have Border Collies. We have Dobermans. For our live find, we of course have Bloodhounds that everybody thinks, you know, it's going to be the dog that's going to come find you if you're lost. But we also have a Cocker Spaniel that does it as well. So again, as long as they have the drive and they can do the job, breeding is not the most important thing.
So what's the smallest type of dog that you've seen as a search and rescue dog?
So the smallest one on our team is a little Cocker Spaniel. She's about 20 pounds. You don't want too small of a dog because if you're in the woods, it can be dangerous, you know, for the dog. And you don't want the dog to get lost or hurt. You know, we certainly don't want dogs that are not tolerant of the heat or dogs that don't have the endurance. So that's all part of, you know, the training for the dog is they have to be able to work in the heat. They can't be afraid of the woods. They, you know, they have to have some degree of independence and, you know, agility and workability and, again, endurance and tolerance. They, you know, they also have to be tolerant of being cooped up. So we, you know, sometimes we'll have to drive several hours to do a search. Dogs in the car in a crate, has to stay in the crate while the other dogs are working and then be let out and work immediately. So again, it's a lot of it is conditioning as to how we train them for how we think we're going to work them.
So talk to us a little bit about what that training process is like. Like what's the first thing you do?
So the very first thing you do, and I just went through this with my puppy. He's about 6 months old. So I started when he was really young, and you introduce an odor as soon as they go over and sniff it, just because they're curious, you reward him. So you reward them with food typically first, because everybody likes to eat. right? So some people also use what's called a mark. So if you've heard of people talking about clicker training, that's what a mark is. So they use the clicker to tell the dog, you're right, a reward is coming. They do that because it's easier to time it than throwing a ball or getting food to them or whatever. So a mark can be a word, it can be a clicker, but typically with us, it's a word. So some people will use the word yes, some people will use free or break. Again, it's just something that tells them, yes, you're right. You're gonna get a reward for that.
Do you have a favorite word that you like to use for them?
Well, it's funny because my first dog I used the word yes, and you don't realize how often you use the word yes. So you inadvertently are saying the dog's like, well, where's my reward? So I've switched to free on my second dog. But yeah, it's one of those words that you shouldn't use for anything else, and you realize how often you use it for something else, you know, after you've already gotten used to that particular word.
All right. So after you've completed the first step, at what stage really, I guess, do they finally get to go out in the field?
Well, for our team, you have to be certified, which again, typically takes about a year. So again, you'll start off slow, again, introducing them to the odor. Once they've been introduced to the odor, then you ask them to give you some sort of final trained response. Final trained response can be a sit, it can be a bark, it can be where they stop and stare at it. So something that shows you that's where the odor is, because often we can't see it. So we have to go just by their nose. So we have to get to a point where we can certify on 6 different environments. So that would be open area, which is like you go out into the woods, or buried, water, rubble, vehicles, and buildings. So we have to have all of those things, and we test all of those things in one sitting. And if you fail, at least the instructor that we had, if you fail, you have to start all over.
Oh my goodness.
So if you fail on number 5, you have to start off at 1 again and go back through, right? And it's what's called blind, meaning I can't see where that odor is. I have to rely on the dog, and I have to be within a certain distance from it. So again, it's a pretty specific test, and the dogs have to be pretty spot on.
It sounds like it. So I have a weird question. So if you're training a dog to be a human remains dog, where do you get that smell?
That is the most common question we There's lots of different sources. So there is artificial scent. We like to use real scent. There's lots of different sources that we can get that from placentas. We can use teeth. We can use bones. We can use like cremains, like ashes, things like that. Now the dogs have to know that whole different variation in the scent. Obviously a dry bone is going to smell different than a whole person. And they, again, have to kind of learn that whole spectrum. But yeah, that's a very common question.
Yeah, that it sounds so interesting to me, just because I've never ever participated in anything like that. I guess I've seen some competitions on TV for search and rescue dogs where they're led into a building and they have to find certain number of items or whatever in the room.
Correct.
But I just think it's fascinating. So I hope you don't get called out very often, considering you're looking for human remains. But how often do you get called out?
Surprisingly often. I would say on a given month, once, twice, every once in a while, it'll be 3 or more a month.
Wow.
And yeah, it's always surprising to me that there's that many incidents that require our attention, right? Because that means there's 10 times as many that didn't require it, right? So a lot of times it's cold cases or the police got a tip about something and they send us out. If it was easy to find, they wouldn't need us
right,
to do it, right? So it's always the harder to find things that we get called out for.
So, so you're search and rescue of Central Florida. So is that just like our tri-county or 5-county area, or what, how big is the area that you guys serve?
Well, we're nationally certified, so we could, in theory, go anywhere in the country, but it's typically, kind of Central Florida, east to West Coast, right? So we have some members that live in Jacksonville and Ocala and Gainesville, so sometimes we'll go up that way. We've been out to Clearwater, Kissimmee, Polk County. So again, anywhere that is required, we will go. Again, we are certified nationally, so we could go anywhere in the country.
Okay, so we hear about natural disasters that happen all over the world, like earthquakes, for example. Would you ever get called out on some sort of an international type case?
We probably could. Usually those are FEMA dogs. So FEMA has their own separate dogs that are trained for that type of thing that are very, very specifically trained. So those dogs basically are interchangeable as far as they all have the same response. They all have, they have to meet very strict requirements. It's quite intense to be FEMA certified. So depending if it was a local one, I do think some of the more local disasters, local people have been called out, but usually that's the national organizations that do that.
And at the national level, are those people actually employees or are they still volunteers?
I believe they're still all volunteers.
Okay, wow.
I'm not positive about that though.
Yeah, so I mean, you probably get called out on a moment's notice. It's not like you can rearrange your whole life necessarily, but.
Well, it depends. So if we're looking for somebody who we think is still alive, certainly that's a more pressing thing. And then that's drop everything, all hands on deck. If it's a cold case, usually we can schedule it when we can get the most dogs out there. Every once in a while we'll get a call that says, get in the car, go now. But that, usually we have a day or so notice. Because again, we're not looking for anybody that's easy to find. They've done all that legwork in theory before they call us.
And do they make you do double duty as a vet and as a handler?
Correct. So
Figured.
get to have me around because if something does happen to one of the dogs, I'm right there to take care of them. So yes.
Well, I'm looking at the Search and Rescue Central Florida.us website, and I'm looking at some of the roles that are available, and they are, it really is kind of interesting. Everything from ham. Radio operators to boat operators to financial, mechanics, medical, first responders, planning and logistics, rehab, including food and water and shelter. And then I saw that veterinary care and I thought maybe they might use you for more than one thing.
Correct, they do. And there's, if people are looking for a way to volunteer and a way to give back, there's something that everybody can plug into, right? So not everybody needs to go out in the field because it's not easy, right? It's hot, it's wet, there's snakes, there's alligators. That's not for everybody, but we need people back at Central Command to make sure everybody's signing in and signing out. We need people to help make sure our website is okay and our radios are working. And so there's something for everyone as far as volunteer opportunities.
Well, I'm looking at this and I think I want to be a flanker.
So flankers are basically they come with the dog and the handler. Sometimes there's one, sometimes there are two. Their job is to make sure that we stay on track, that we don't get lost, because the handlers are looking at the dog, making sure the dog's okay. Watching what the dogs do, dogs' behavior, making sure we're getting them to all those right spots. The flankers are there to protect all of us.
Yeah,
So
I think I would like that one the best for sure.
come on, sign up. Let's go.
Definitely. Do you ever use horses?
There are some places that use horses. Our particular team does not, but they say that they are quite good at it. I've heard that they are good at it.
That's the part I want to do. I want to ride the horse and be the
There you
flanker.
go.
So, all right. So, what else would you tell us that we? That I'm forgetting to ask, but that people would really love to know about.
Well, again, that it's an all-volunteer organization. We train these dogs ourselves. We all their expenses are all on us. And it's a great organization, is a great way to give back if anyone wants to give back their time or their money. That's always a good way. We could always use that support. We just recently purchased GPS collars for the dogs. So when they're out in the field, we can watch, you know, everybody can watch them and make sure that A, we're covering where we're supposed to be covering and that everybody gets home safely. So
yeah, I love that.
Yeah, we could always use money.
Money, yep, definite for sure. Especially because those GPS collars are not cheap.
No, they are not. And even going out on some of these, you know, calls is not cheap. So say we get a call in Tampa, we drop everything. If I'm missing work, I'm missing income. I'm, you know, spending my gas, my hotel, my food, you know, it's not a cheap endeavor for us, but again, that's my way of giving back. And it's, again, if somebody can't give their time, then their money is just as good.
Yeah. And a great way to spend some real quality time with your dog and people.
Oh, for sure. And it's a great group of people. And it's a great way to bond with your dog because there's no better bond than you're out in the woods and you're trusting your dog 100% and they're trusting you, right? You know, you have to make sure they get home safe and they're out there to do their job. And there's nothing more rewarding than bringing back someone who's lost.
Oh, absolutely. Right. And you hear a lot more about, you know, the live ones probably on the news than you would hear about anything else, but.
Yeah. I mean, and if you're hearing about a case on the news, we're probably involved. We don't really publicize it. That's not kind of how we like to present ourselves. We're the quiet in the background doing our job. We're not there to say, oh, hey, look at me. So you'll never see us on the news. You'll never see us posting anything about, you know, our searches or whatever. Our job is to go quietly, go in and do our job and come out.
Well, thank you for all you do in the background because it's so, so, so important. And we just, I think a lot of people are just not even aware that this A exists or B that we really need it.
Right. Again, I was pleasantly surprised in a way that my dog would get enough work, right, to keep out and go and do this. But it happens a lot. Like we get called out quite a bit.
Well, fortunately, the weather's getting a little better here in Florida. So hopefully in the next few months, you won't be quite as hot.
Yeah, it's been brutal, but it's nice out right now.
Yeah, it is lovely. Okay, so when you're not out working with your search and rescue dogs, you are working as a Central Florida veterinarian. Tell us a little bit about your practice.
So we are a fairly small practice, four doctor practice in Winter Springs. Dr. Williams and I actually went to vet school together. We both went to Auburn. And then we have Dr. Walker and Dr. West as well. Nice part about our practice is everybody likes a little bit of different things. So Dr. Walker really likes dentistry. So she's really good at that. I really like surgery. So that's what I tend to do. Dr. West and Dr. Williams, they would rather, you know, see patients than be in the surgery suite or the dental suite. So it's a nice combination of things. We're still privately owned, which is also very nice these days with, you know, corporate buying a bunch of practices.
Please stay that way.
I know. He's trying. We are still privately owned. He says they'd have to rip this from his cold dead hand. So we'll see.
Oh, well, actually that would be nice because you're becoming a dinosaur.
That is the truth. That is the truth. Unfortunately, I just graduated. My 30-year vet school reunion was this past weekend. So I've been out for 30 years. Like you said in the beginning, my dad is 83, still practicing. And our type of practice style is not what you're going to see going with the, you know, the next generation, which is progress. That's how it goes, I suppose.
Well, in some ways it's progress, but then in some ways I feel like maybe the opportunity isn't as great because now you're not an entrepreneur per se.
I think it's like everything else. It has its pros and its cons, right? I think you probably have better work-life balance than say my father's generation. You know, my father's generation, they worked 6-7 days a week, saw calls on the weekends. You know, my generation got to have emergency clinics where we weren't being called out in the middle of the night, you know, but we still worked pretty hard. The next generation may have a better work-life balance. And a big problem in veterinary medicine is actually the suicide rate.
Really?
So veterinarians have one of the highest per profession suicide rate.
Right behind dentists, I guess.
Right. We're right in that same category with dentists. And they think part of that is work-life balance, that people are just really, really tired. They're just burned out, emotionally speaking, because it's an emotional job, you know?
Oh, like being an estate planning attorney.
Well, right. I mean, you know, you're having to have uncomfortable conversations
daily. Yes, you I know? Understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard. And, you know, so again, I think it has its pros and its cons. I think people do want their friendly neighborhood veterinarian, the veterinarian they've seen for years and years. I still think they still like that. I hope that's not going to go away.
I hope not either, because I think it's true. I think we care almost more about who our veterinarian is than we do about who our primary care physician is.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Just because
again, I would much prefer to trust you than a primary care person for myself.
Well, and again, veterinarians, you know, are jacks of all trade as far as medicine goes, right? So we're your pediatrician, we're your senior doctor's dog, we're your surgeon, we're your dentist, we're all of those things. So it takes a lot of trust in that person.
Definitely.
To trust your baby. These are your babies.
Oh, they are so much our babies. And we spend a lot of time worrying about their everyday health. And because really, when they're not happy, we're not happy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I know you know that to be true.
It is true. It is true. And again, you want to know that your veterinarian cares about your pet and is has your pet's best interest in mind. And you know, one of the complaints we hear is, oh, it costs so much. And we don't want it to cost that much. It's just, unfortunately, the lights cost a lot to have on. The medicines, you know, everything just price-wise is really just out of hand. And we have to make a living, too, with this. Because if we didn't, then nobody would do it.
You wouldn't do it, right? Well, yeah. And then there's the odd incidents now. I call it odd. I don't know if it really is, but I had the opportunity to speak to a veterinary class, and it was like 99% women.
When I went to vet school, it was not. It was probably 70-30 men to women. Now it's much more heavily female.
What do you think that has caused that trend?
I think it's, and this may be reverse gender discrimination. I think women tend to be a little more empathetic and, you know, and caring. And I think that's what attracts people to veterinary medicine, right? You know, it's not just medicine, it's medicine plus caring. Right. So, you know, you can be really smart, and some really smart people will be rocket scientists. But the really empathetic smart people become veterinarians. And that's a double-edged sword, right? So we care so much, but then we see so many sad things. You know, these guys only live 12, 14 years.
I know.
So in your career, you're going to see a lot of these pets, you know, go from being this cute little puppy to their senior years and losing them. So again, we see that whole gamut, and we become attached, you know, to these pets, to their families. And so that's the hard part, is it attracts these empathetic personalities that then it comes out back and bites you, because we're so empathetic that it's a hard job to do if you're really empathetic, right?
So we know that you suffer right along with us.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. One of the hardest things we have to do is to let our patients go and, you know, to be there with our owners while it's happening. So that, you know, those are difficult times for everybody.
Do you have an opinion you'd be willing to share about these in-home euthanasia services?
I think they're lovely. I think they're lovely. I think it's a business, but it's a service that a lot of dogs hate to go in the car. They hate the clinical setting, you know, of a veterinary hospital. There's other things going on. I think it's a lovely way to transition right out of this life. I think it's, and the companies that are out there now that are doing it are fantastic with it. They just do a fabulous job. Again, super empathetic, you know, spend lots of time with people, really have it dialed in where it's the nicest experience possible.
The people that I know that have used those services really do say that it's far superior to kind of the more sterile or clinical environment of the office.
100%. It's a lovely service.
I mean, I guess for ourselves, if we had a choice, we'd want to stay at home too, right?
Amen to that. Sign me up.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so why dogs and cats and not exotic animals or horses or something else?
Well, in vet school, I really liked dairy cows. Like, that was my favorite thing, was dairy cows. But I wanted to be back in Florida. There aren't that many dairies in Florida, and it's hot. And I really like surgery, and small animal surgery is probably where you're going to get the most game time, right? The most opportunities to do lots of different surgeries all the time.
Sure. So, well, I said just dogs and cats, but do you do other small animals as well?
Primarily, I feel like at this point, the people that do the exotics are so good at it that it's, you're better served going to see those people that are really good at it. Okay. Right. That, you know, back in the day, you kind of had to, like my dad's generation, you had to see whatever walked in the door. We can do what we're best at and leave those things to those people who are really good at that. You know, that's their job.
Yeah. Well, we so appreciate you and your profession and everything that the veterinarians of this world do for our animals that we love so much and who have such a hard time, if not an impossible time, telling us what's wrong with them.
Well, we appreciate you good pet owners that take good care of them.
Absolutely. Well, I always have to encourage people to, and you probably have this happen in your practice. I want people, of course, to make a plan for their pet so that if something happens to them, their pet has a forever home. But I bet you get asked on a regular basis to be that forever home.
I have been. Not a ton, but I have been. Correct. That has happened. And I've agreed, especially on dogs that it's been mostly dogs. I don't know that I've had a family ask me to take care of their cat if something passed with them that I can think of. But there's one dog in particular that yes, I am on his list of if something happens to his mom that I will get him.
Okay. So. Well, I chose for one of my pet caregivers, a gal who's a vet tech over in, she's at the Virginia Tech now at their veterinary school.
But, nice.
Yeah, she's a technician and does horses. So because I have horses, that she was a good fit for me. So thank you again for doing that. So, okay, listeners, we had this great call today with Dr. Patty Palumbo. She's a canine handler for Search and Rescue of Central Florida. She's also one of the lead veterinarians at Seminole Trail Animal Hospital located in Winter Springs, Florida. We're so pleased to have you with us today. Is there anything you would want to leave us with here today, Dr. Palumbo?
Just again, be kind to your veterinarians. They're doing the best that they can. You know, we aren't in this for the money. We're in this for the love of pets and that human animal bond. So if you can choose to be kind to your veterinarians and your veterinary staff, that would be great. It's actually Veterinary Technician Week this week.
Oh, awesome.
And the technicians are definitely the unsung heroes. You know, these guys and gals really, really work hard to, again, help ensure that our pets are healthy, that they get the best health care. Again, kind of like nurses, if you want blood drawn, don't ask the doctor, ask the nurse, you know, so that the technicians really, really are the backbone of what we do. And, you know, I feel like they do get beat up a little bit and people don't appreciate how hard their job is. So,
oh, I love my vet techs. They're the best always.
They're awesome. So again, if you can be kind or reach out to your, you know, anybody in the veterinary profession right now, that's a nice thing to do.
Okay. So National Veterinary Technician
Week.
Appreciation Week.
Correct.
So
correct.
Drop by your vet's office. Say some nice words or take your vet techs some cookies or donuts.
Cookies or donuts are always welcome. Everybody always.
Or some love.
There you go. Anything is any appreciation they like at this point.
Absolutely. Well, thank you to our listeners for joining us today on All My Children Wear Fur Coats. And a special thank you to Dr. Patty Palumbo. You guys know my favorite motto. It is, until there are none, please adopt one. And we look forward to talking to you each and every week on All My Children Wear Fur Coats. Please join us next time. Happy tales.
Thank you for joining us on All My Children Wear Fur Coats with your host, Peggy Hoyt. We hope you learned something valuable for the benefit of your pet. We want to keep loved pets in loving homes by educating pet parents about the importance of ensuring every pet has a forever home. Get more information about creating a legacy for your pet at animalcaretrustusa.org or legacyforyourpet.com. Buy a copy of All My Children Wear Fur Coats, How to Leave a Legacy for Your Pet on Amazon. Join our email list or make a donation. Pet professionals and advisors are invited to join our trusted advisor network. Until next time, happy tales!